And now please welcome government expert on depleted uranium, discussing the health and environmental effects of uranium munitions in war and what we need to do to clean it up, Dr. Doug Rocky.
Good evening. The purpose of war is real simple. When you go to war, I don't care whether you're a medic like Dennis, and I'm an old combat medic also. I don't care whether you're a cook, a member of the band. Your job is to kill and destroy, period. When you go to war, you're going to come back changed, physiologically and psychologically forever. When we go to war, because our purpose is to kill and destroy, the military will use any and every weapon at their disposal to kill and destroy. Period. There's nothing about it. It's simply killing and destroying. And anybody that gets in your way gets killed, and anything item that's in your way gets destroyed. During Gulf War I, now remember, when Gulf War I started in August of 1990, that weekend I spent it with Paul Tibbetts. Now, for those of you who know about American history and world history, Paul Tibbetts was the commander of the Enola Gay. He's the guy that dropped the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. When the war started, I was with him and the remainder of his crew. And we talked about what happened in World War II and what was about to happen in Gulf War I. And it happened. Gulf War I was the largest friendly fire incident in the history of American warfare. And the reason for that is because all of the exposures had happened. When I got activated when the Gulf War I started, the first few months, I spent 3 days of the week teaching nuclear and biological chemical warfare preparations and medical care and treatment, because that's my specialty for many, many years. I came in the military in 1967. I'm still in the Army. Let's see, that's 36 years and counting. I don't know how many people usually get out at 20. How many people stay for 36 and count? When we got to Gulf War I, what happened was a whole complex exposures. Chemical agents. Hey, we knew what Iraq had as far as chemical agents because of the fact that the United States gave it to them and we kept the receipt. Hey, that's the Regal Commission report, the United States Senate, prepared by Jim Toot. It was a subject of a made-for-TV movie that we did starring Ted Danson and Mark Helgenberger called Thanks of a Grateful Nation. It's really neat when you write part of a movie script to have somebody like Ted Danson read your lines. Okay? I just bypassed it. I only had a small bit part in the movie. You know, you saw the back of my head and I was gone. Chemical agents. So what we did in December of 1990, we made a conscious decision at the command headquarters to deliberately and willfully blow up chemical stockpiles along with the biological stockpiles, along with the nuclear reactors that Iraq possessed. We knew where they were. We knew what he had. This is in Schwarzkopf's autobiography, page 390, if you want to look for the reference. I was there. Some 10 years after the war, a couple of years ago, we all got called up to the Washington, D.C. for the 10th anniversary. The command staff did. I'm sitting there with the commanders, and we're talking about it. And they said, well, Doug, we sure did screw that one up. And I go, yeah, we did, all the way around. All we did was hit an ice cube with a hammer. And all the chemical and biological stuff came back on the U.S. troops and everybody in the region. Immunizations. They made a thing to immunizations. They hadn't bothered to maintain immunizations like you're supposed to for a physician treating a patient. So everybody got all their shots at once. The guys were in their shorts, and the women were in their bras and their shorts, and everybody walked through the line, and we put one or two shots in each arm and each butt, and then they threw them over a table and did an IgG shot. Hey, a night's mess. Everybody's sick already. The anthrax vaccine. When the anthrax vaccine got into theater, we had a direct order not to record dose, batch, who got what the adverse effects and everything was. The stuff wasn't temperature regulated, and people were getting sick right away. I administered thousands of anthrax vaccines and got three myself. Radiological materials. Well, we blew up the reactors and DU, and I'll talk about DU in a minute. Endemic diseases. Unbelievable endemic diseases. Not only did everybody from all the nations bring all their endemic diseases with them, you know, hey, this is one big get-together party, but the endemic diseases in the desert are unbelievable. Hazardous materials. Anytime you move a city or an army or you blow up an infrastructure, you release toxic industrial chemicals from everything that you can think of in a city, in a community, in industry. Unbelievable releases. People were sick all over the place. Pesticides. Well, we had a significant problem. We knew the desert was dirty. We're no one going in the area. We got food and everything all over the place, so we need to get pesticides. Before we left Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, you have to understand, I'm in the unit responsible for theater, environmental health, and occupational safety. We were the theater experts. Well, we ordered our pesticides according to, you know, EPA guidelines under CFR 40, but they didn't come in. So we got over to the theater, and two of our officers went out and bought everything on the open market. We have no idea what was sprayed on everybody. Biological agents. Iraq absolutely possessed them, because guess where they came from? The U.S. Army. USAMRID. It's all in a Regal Commission report. But it's more important. The United Nations, you know, demanded a report from Iraq that basically started this war. The missing pages detailed all of the U.S. industries and the U.S. military's direct delivery of all of the weapons and chemical and biological stockpiles to Iraq. That's what happened, but that's why the pages were missing. Oil well fires, unbelievable complex organic, inorganic, and particulates and heavy metal exposures. The oil well fire started, and ladies and gentlemen, the oil well fires are going on right now. And guess who's got the contract to clean them up? Yeah, I guess who owns Halliburton? Isn't it neat when you send the guys to war and the company makes money? Dickie Cheney. Unbelievable complexities. The people were so sick right off the bat that at the command headquarters, we issued a medical directive that nobody should be anywhere near the oil fires without full respiratory and skin protection. Now, you understand, everybody was trying to get popsicle sticks and Q-tips. Remember Grandma and Ma said, don't stick your finger up your nose to clean it out? Hey, the only way you could get this stuff out of your nose and your ears and your mouth was with a popsicle stick, because you scraped it out like tar. And the health effects were all over. And we issued a medical directive requiring full respiratory and skin protection, and they never got it. Well, all this stuff is happening. And all these exposures are happening, and we're at the Theater Medical Command headquarters. We're trying to get the information out. And you asked the question about control of the press and media flat out. We had senior military officers came from the Pentagon and tried to stop us from teaching, tried to stop us from setting up medical care. And those are the same guys that released anthrax a few years ago on the United States. Same guys. Because the only place that the AIM strain of anthrax came from is U.S. Army lab at USAMRID. No place else that has it in the world. And if you've ever been up there working, and I have, you can't even get a fart out of that building. So we come to the Gulf War. And in December of 1990, now you got to understand, I've been in and around the military for 23 years. Okay? I'm sitting there in and around, doing all the stuff, teaching nuclear bombs, chemical warfare, and I ain't never heard of depleted uranium until December of 1990. I get a letter from Colonel Charles Day at the Pentagon, says, Doug, you better start thinking about depleted uranium. And I go, what's this? Well, we did a little research and we found out. Then the ground war happened. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the ground war was held up until February 25th of 1991 for two very specific reasons, or three specific reasons. Number one, we didn't have the medical care in place to deal with chemical and biological and radiological casualties. Number two, we didn't have the protective equipment and clothing and gas masks, enough mop suits and enough gas mask filters to replace if we went to war and they used it. And number three, we didn't have everybody educated and trained on how to use it. Bowers Radius, for which I was a member, the Theater Nuclear Biochemical Warfare Special Operations Team, finished teaching the theater command staff at 1:15 in the afternoon, on the day before, Saturday afternoon before we started the ground war. When it was completed, the Colonel Bauer, who's in charge of our team, a physician, sent the message up to the theater command staff and said, the train is on time. That was the code words for starting the ground battle, the fact that everybody was ready. Colonel Ulrich Bauer issued the order to start the ground war. Then they decided to use uranium munitions. And we shot the heck out of everything, because uranium munitions are probably the most effective combat weapon you're ever going to encounter. These things are the silver bullet. They kill and destroy anything in their path. They're extremely effective. And what you need to understand, and contrary to what you saw in the media, the DU round is not coated and it is not tipped. The DU round is solid uranium-238. The M1 tank round is over 10 pounds of solid uranium-238 contaminated with plutonium, neptunium, and americium. We got a plastic sabot that fits in there that takes the diameter of the round, which is about 3/4 inch, up to 120 millimeter. The minute that thing leaves the tube, the bore of the gun, the plastic sabot falls away, and all you have is a gigantic uranium dart, just like you're playing darts, moving at unbelievable velocity, downrange to impact anything and everything. Now, when that 10-pound uranium dart strikes wood, metal, steel, iron, or anything, this thing is already on fire in flight. The uranium is pyrophoric and very soft. Uranium is not hard, it's soft. But the density is unbelievable. Extremely heavy per unit volume. So you got this uranium dart that's basically 3/4 inch in diameter, 18 inches long, moving at better than 3,000 feet per second. And when it strikes, you have what we call spalling is formed. About 40% to 50% of the dart breaks off and forms spalling. Now, the spalling is uranium fragments. Now, some of the stuff catches fire and some of the stuff's just solid uranium. And what you see inside is if I took a handful of BBs and threw it across this room, extremely high velocity, everything is on fire and fragments, you have secondary detonations due to concussion and ignition beyond comprehension. And the whole thing is a catastrophic explosion. During Gulf War I, we fired approximately 380 tons of solid uranium. This is just a solid uranium component. This is not the shells. 380 tons of solid uranium. Now, that came from the individual that actually issued the uranium munitions, who was a member of my team. Totally confirmed by the guy that sent it over from the States, Bill Huber, and totally confirmed by the guy that issued it in the state, in theater, David Kiefer. Well, we fired about 15,000 rounds of the M1 A1 10-pound round, and we fired over 1 million rounds of the A10 round. Now, the A10 round, each individual round is 300 grams, about 3/4 pound of solid uranium. It's got a very, very slight copper shell on it, coating, just to protect the gun barrel when it fires out of the Gowie 8, but it doesn't last very long. Falls right off. That fires at a rate of 4,000 rounds a minute, a ton and a half of solid uranium per minute out of an A-10. Unbelievable rates. So when this stuff impacts, you get contamination that's spread all over the place. In and around the vehicle, the contamination's extensive. Now, you have to understand the majority of casualties and deaths during Gulf War I on the U.S. side were caused by friendly fire. That means that the U.S. shot and killed their own. The U.S. shot and wounded their own. That's other soldiers in M1 tanks shooting up our own. But the U.S. also shot up the British. Now, when that happened, our team was refused permission to provide medical care for the British, and we refused permission to do the investigations because the U.S. command didn't want that knowledge out that it was friendly fire from U.S. I got a direct order from Norman G. Schwarzkopf. And he was ordered by the Pentagon to assign me to clean up the DU mess. That's what I'm working on today. I'm still finishing that order. I'm an Army officer. I'm a warrior, honest to God warrior, many, many years. Okay? Vietnam and Desert Storm. Now, when I got up there, assigned to the team as a theater health physicist and the health physicist on the DU assessment team, and also the medic on the DU assessment team, I'm an old combat medic from the line infantry from 3 years. many, many years ago, because I've been in the military a long time and done a lot of different things. We got up there and we all started getting sick within 72 hours. The respiratory problems and the rashes started within 72 hours, not only on our team, but we were seeing this on a friendly fire. And I immediately directed medical care for all DU casualties as the theater health physicist. According to Army regulation, the person responsible for directing implementation of medical care. And I got a shit pot full of medals for doing it, but they never implemented it. I went all over the place trying to get medical care for the individuals. If you watch some of our movies, very specifically Hidden Wars or Invisible Wars, you'll see Jerry Weed in them. Jerry Weed was in a Bradley fighting vehicle. It was shot two times by an Abrams tank, 120-millimeter round. These guys are round happy, shoot them up happy. They see a target out there. They put their sights on it, and they pull the trigger. They don't give a shit. Their job is to kill and destroy. Jerry Weed's in there. He got shot up. Some guys got killed. The guy that got killed in this take, I scraped off his brains with a 6-inch putty knife. You ever know what it's like to keep, kill up, scrape up body parts with a putty knife? Put them in a garbage bag? You can't bring them back to the States. We bury them in Saudi Arabia. Reality is, war is death. Now, I went to Jerry's commander and directed medical care for him right away. Coordinated his medical care with theater medical command staff. Never happened. Never happened. In June of 1991, we're writing all our reports. It took our team of super scientist engineers. Some of us were already in theater. Other ones were brought over. Took us 3 months to clean up 24 U.S. vehicles for shipment back to the United States. That's 15 Abrams tanks, 9 Bradley fighting vehicles, and I buried a whole bunch in a hole in Saudi Arabia. They've asked Dave Kiefer and I a bunch of times to go tell them where they buried them so they can go scrape them up again, and we told them not only no, but hell no. And my commander from the Gulf War is still backing it up. Because those are got body parts, like unexploded ordnance, and radioactive contamination and chemical contamination, and the minute you crack that cap, those suckers are going to blow up on you. You can't mess with this stuff. Now, there's no unexploded ordnance, you know, that's safe. When this stuff goes under fire, everything is very unstable. Now, EOD experts in the Army won't touch this stuff, ladies and gentlemen, which means that the Army Contaminated Equipment Recovery Team, which I'm the health physicist of, or we were as long as we were in favor, are the only guys that do it. Every single member of the Army's ACER team is under disability today, with a minimum of 40%, except for one guy. And that guy just did the paperwork. Every member of the U.S. Army's primary experts are sick from exposures, from just cleaning it up. It took us 3 months to clean up 24 vehicles. Nobody knew how to do anything. The only manual we had was Technical Bulletin 9-1300-278 that Rich Flazar wrote and put out right before Gulf War I started. Ladies and gentlemen, Rich is dead from lymphoma from uranium exposures. He's one of my best friends. That's the only thing we had. So we had to figure out what we do. Medical care? Oh, we direct it. How do we clean it up? Jesus, I don't know. It's full of unexploded ordnance. We got to remove the unexploded ordnance. We got to decontaminate. We got to package these vehicles. And we did this. The 144th maintenance, members of the 32nd, members of the 92nd Med Battalion, members of the 12th, members of the TACOM staff, and everybody's sick or dead. And medical care is still not being provided. Well, what we did is we figured out, how do I remove unexploded ordnance? Well, you climb in there and you carefully remove it. Jesus, we're Army doctors. But there ain't nobody else doing it. And the 144th guys are out there basically in their combat boots and cut-off camis doing the work. Because, hey, nobody told them that this stuff was dangerous and they need to wear full respiratory and skin protection. Well, we got up there, and in March of 1991, I started getting letters. You understand, I got a direct order through General Schwarzkopf from the Pentagon, the assigned by name to clean up the mess. To this day, I have no idea why they picked me, and I can guarantee you they wish they never did pick me. I got a letter and a memorandum that came from Los Alamos, the famous Los Alamos memorandum. And in this memorandum was very, very clear. Thou shalt write your after-action reports such that they do not reveal the health and environmental consequences of uranium emissions because they will become politically unacceptable. Direct order. I'll be damned if I'm going to lie for the military. Then I got another direct order. Then I got another order came down from the Defense Nuclear Agency, written by Colonel Gregory Lyle. And Greg Lyle said it's not only DUDS a health risk, he said it's a serious health concern. Now, Colonel Lyle at that time worked for Colonel Asif Durakovich. Now, you people will hear about Asif Durakovich, a doctor, uranium medical research program, you know, but they failed to tell you he was the U.S. Army's top doctor in this stuff until he blew the whistle. You have to understand, he was the Army's expert, a physician, a Ph.D., M.D. physician, until he blew the whistle. They don't like to hear this from the experts. So all this stuff is coming about. We're seeing all of the problems. We're trying to get medical care. I can't get medical care for friendly fire casualties. We're working our butt off. We're doing everything we possibly can. Medal after medal for doing all this stuff. You know, we did medical directives right away. Well, we got up in there, and in June of 1991, Theater Medical Commander issued a medical directive for DU, treating DU casualties, locating, evaluating, treating soldiers with retained depleted uranium shrapnel, 13 June 1991. Medical directive. To this day, it's never been complied with. In here, every unit that had casualties was listed. We knew every person that was hit. We knew every person that had high-level exposures, over 400 of them. Every name, what unit they were in, and it's still never been complied with. Well, all this stuff keeps on going on. We come back and we start writing our reports. I mean, we are writing reports. We're trying to get medical care. We're trying to get everything done. Well, we not only had this thing about the doing the depleted uranium, I also had the responsibility for the captured equipment project, which means that I had the responsibility for doing the assessment on Iraq's military weapons capability and the hazardous materials associated with it. Hey, I got a medal from this commanding general for doing the work. Hey, we knew in 1991 that Iraq didn't possess any defensive, much less offensive capability. So why'd we go to war in Gulf War II? They were barely capable of protecting themselves, as history has proven again over the last 3 weeks. It was a cakewalk. There was no combat. Other than we blew everything up. Well, we're getting all of these directives. In March of 1991, I get another thing came down from Rich Lazar through the Army Command. And in here at point blank said that this uranium dust, the majority, it's going to go into the body, and 43% of this stuff, just like Loren explained from her research, goes right into the bloodstream. The other stuff sits in the lung and irradiates in the lung forever, at 300 millirems per hour, beta gammas, and about 10,000 alpha, you know, counts per minute alpha particles. This is what she talked about. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you how fast the lungs get scar tissue. They're trashed right away. So the 1943 medical directive, the Los Alamos, what we call the Gross Memorandum she talks about all this stuff. My old medical records there verify that they were right in 43 along with everybody else's. Just keeps on going and going and going. Directive after directive after directive. Well, in 1992, the United States Army was gigged, i.e. found guilty of willful violation of the United States Code under the National Environmental Protection Act, NEPA. And I got called from the University of Illinois to the U.S. Army Construction Energy Research Laboratory, CIRL, to ensure that I put together the programs that the United States military would comply with NEPA. Well, we had some fun doing that one. And if you've been reading recently, the military is trying to get out from under compliance with environmental laws. It's in the new congressional bills. Not even, they're crazy. Well, anyhow, while we were there, the United States Army Environmental Policy Institute got a directive from the United States Senate, a written directive, to come down and conduct studies on the health and environmental effects of uranium on the battlefield. And in this directive, one of the things that was very, very specific is figure out ways to reduce the toxicity of uranium munitions, a written directive from the Senate. Now, if it ain't toxic, why does the Senate need to tell the U.S. Army to figure out ways to reduce the toxicity? Duh. That's because everybody knows it's toxic. You can't do this. Well, while we're doing that, all of a sudden I get a directive from the United States Department of State, because we're doing environmental, to write up the theater cleanup plan to clean up Iraq, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia of all uranium munitions. So Colonel David Lindsay, who was my actual colonel commander during the Gulf War for the DU and Captured Equipment Project, Dr. Gary Brinkley, one of the foremost EOD experts, unexploded ordnance experts, demolition experts in the world, and myself wrote up the theater cleanup plan. We passed it up for General Paul Greenberg, on all the way up through the Secretary of the Army, who passed it across to the Secretary of State, who passed it off to the Emirate of Kuwait. Guess who we ordered to write the cleanup plan for? Brown and Root! Who owns Brown and Root? Yeah, who owns Halliburton? Dickie Cheney. God, I'd love it when a plan comes together. Got to send people to war so my company can make money. It never stops. In June of 1993, while we're doing all this stuff, I was directed by Colonel Eric Daxon to write an after-action report on the health and environmental effects and all this stuff, make recommendations through the Surgeon General of the United States Army on what to do to solve the DU program project. And I did. I had a great time doing it. Covered everything. Okay? Identified all the training requirements, identified the medical requirements. They were loving us as long as we stayed to what they wanted. Well, from this letter and everything else, General Eric Shinseki, now you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're at war right now, okay? The purpose of war is to kill and destroy. The chief of staff of the Army is General Eric Shinseki. Guess who sent your sons and your daughters into war? Eric Shinseki. Now, back in August of 1993, General Eric Shinseki, signed an order directing that provide adequate training for personnel to come in contact with DU, complete medical testing, and develop the cleanup plan. Jesus. And these generals ain't complying with it? Ain't that a UCMJ violation for court-martial? It sure is, as far as I know in all my years in the military. Well, ain't never been complied with. In October of 1993, the United States was going to battle in this little old backward country called Somalia. We were going to use uranium munitions in Somalia against ox carts. Ain't that neat? Let's see. I got a DU round. A thing catches fire when it leaves the bore of the gun. I need food, so therefore when I shoot this ox, it'll be killed and cooked and ready to eat. We got this stopped. But we did get a medical directive issued by Colonel Peter Myers, by directive of the Surgeon General, by directive of the Secretary of the Army and the Secretary of Defense, requiring medical care for all DU casualties. Direct quote, medical care will be provided for, now direct quote A, being in the midst of smoke from DU fires resulting from the burning of vehicles uploaded with DU munitions or depots in which DU munitions are being stored. B, working with environments containing DU dust or residues from DU fires. And C, being within a structure or vehicle when it's struck with DU munitions. Still covers everything. Required a radio bioassay within 24 hours for all U.S. soldiers. This is 1993. Well, it ain't never been complied with today. Now, if that's a medical directive that's required for U.S. soldiers, that's a medical directive that has to be required for all coalition soldiers, our allies. But when you win a war, according to the Geneva Convention, that's the medical care that must be provided to the enemy. But under God, you must provide that same medical care to the women and the children of the world. And I'll be damned if they're doing it. Well, we put all this stuff together. And I'm sitting at the University of Illinois having a field day. You know, I've already come back from Cyril where I did NEPA and worked on the API study. And all of a sudden, I get a letter from the Army and says, congratulations, you won the Cubidol again. You're going back on active duty as the director of the depleted uranium project. Now, this is 1994. It's a lot of years past. Okay? And at this time, they sent me a letter, and it says, direct quote, on the other hand, you may find a resource is a bit austere, since the Army does not expect funding to be available to fiscal year 96. What this means is you have no travel budget and no assistance, at least officially. We have found, however, that many people in the Army are anxious to help in any way they can. You know, it's kind of like, you want to play Russian roulette? And they issued me one bullet for the gun, and then they put it in and they spun the cylinder and put it up to my head. It never stopped. Well, we fooled them. We got the job done. And in 18 months, I did the research in the Nevada test site where we literally blew up all kinds of Soviet equipment. I had the Marines from 29 Palms, ma'am. Where's that Marine mother? God Almighty, the Marines from 29 Palms are some of the best shots with an Abrams and a Bradley fighting vehicle you'll ever encounter in your life. Man, I put an X on my tank at 3,000 meters and they'd hit the X. They didn't bother to tell them that they're trashing themselves. You know, they don't bother to tell you that. So we did all this research. I burned Bradley fighting vehicles, measured the level of contamination, determined how to clean it up, determined out the extent of contamination, found out within 20 to 50 meters I absolutely had to have full respiratory and skin protection. And that's absolutely in the Common Task Training Manual for uranium exposures for all military. It's absolutely there. Then we went back the next year and I blew everything up. This is Nevada test site, Mercury, Nevada, Area 25. The famed Area 51 is over the hill. There ain't no spacemen there, just weird airplanes. So we got it all done. Real, honest-to-God field research. Not something in a laboratory with a textbook. Not under laboratory controls like you want to do for a scientist for peer-reviewed publications. But honest-to-God field research under real-world conditions. It's a heck of a difference, ladies and gentlemen. And about this time, the U.S. Army Involved Policy Institute report finally came out in 95. Now, we're working all this stuff and working on it all the years or doing the research. And the U.S. Army's own report to the Senate stated, direct quote, no available technology can significantly change the inherent chemical and radiological toxicity of DU. These are intrinsic properties of uranium. Now, we went to Gulf War II here a few weeks ago. And if you watched your media and everything, and you can call to talk to Congressman Jim McDermott, the U.S. military said all the warnings and risks about the health and environmental effects are Iraqi propaganda and other nations trying to prevent uranium munitions from being used. Jesus, come up here and read the documents. They were from all of us and from the U.S. Army's own primary experts. Not Iraqi propaganda, reality going back to 1943 and the Groves Memorandum. Well, we did all this work. We put everything together. I put a 40-hour training program together, Tier 1, 2, and 3. I wrote, directed, and acted in two videos, was technical advisor for about three more. And we had the best education and training program with video support that could be produced for the Department of Defense. And actually, I had officers from England, Australia, Canada, and Germany involved. NATO countries all approved this stuff. Well, the stuff all got shelved. Because they didn't want the troops to know the health and environmental effects of uranium munitions. Because when I did the work as the Army's expert, I reached one simple conclusion. Number one, I can't clean it up. And I can't provide medical care. And the Army will not dedicate the amount of time necessary for education and training to make sure people can safely operate it. When I went in as the director of the DU project, my total intention was to ensure that the military could use uranium munitions in combat. Simply because the job is to kill and destroy. And what I found out when I did the research is you can't use them because you can't clean up and you can't do the medical. And I reached that conclusion and I told them so. I can guarantee you they didn't like that conclusion coming from their expert. They were really, really unhappy. Okay? So we're putting all this stuff together. We got training directive after order, all the way up to the Deputy Secretary of Defense, ordering the education and training to be done. And it's never been done. We got order after order, ordering medical care for everybody. And it's not been done. In 1994, while I was director of the DU project, the U.S. Department of Energy finally, even though the Army's refused and the Department of Veteran Affairs refused to do it, did a radio bioassay on me personally. They didn't bother to tell the Army they were doing it. They just did it because we're working at a U.S. Department of Energy site, Nevada test site, Mercury, Nevada. They got the test result back on January 26th of 1995 that I personally was excreting uranium at 432 micrograms per liter of urine. That's well over 1,300 micrograms per day. They never bothered to tell me for 2.5 years. Now, the reason they knew is when I went in for my physical when I'm on active duty, they found all the respiratory and the calcified granulomas, which is the radiation scar tissue from the picture that Loren held up, causing tissue damage and everything else and all the trash, all the other respiratory problems, all the rashes, and all the kidney problems. They just didn't bother to tell me for 2.5 years. Well, I'm trying to get education and training done. I can't get it done. I'm trying to get medical care done for the friendly fire casualties. I can't get it done. I'm trying to get environmental cleanup. I've wrote the plan, and I can't get it done. So in May of 1997, I coordinated with Tamara Lyons, who's in charge of the Comprehensive Clinical Evaluation Program for the United States Military for Gulf War Illnesses, to provide medical care to all of my staff and the friendly fire guys. And I put a letter up to this Surgeon General's office, Colonel Charles Kelsey, naming them by name. These guys never got care. It's up here. They're dead. They're dead. One of my best friends, John Sitton, the guy that put the medical communications together for the entire theater, the guy that Dennis got all his medical evacuation through with the radio communications, he got zapped with all of the stuff he did and treating, putting care together and putting everything together all over the place for medical evacuation. I mean, the only way you got medical evac was John Sitton getting it up there, wasn't that, Dennis? It's the only way it happened. Well, in 1997, John had developed fast-growing lymphoma cancer from all the exposures. I called up trying to get him medical care. We couldn't get it. He was denied medical care at the Danville, Ileana VA Medical Center in Danville, Illinois. I sent it up to the Surgeon General. I called him up, called the Secretary of Defense, tried to get his medical care. They refused to give it to him. There were no exposures. He wasn't there. He had nothing happen to him medically. One day there was a fire and his records disappeared. Wednesday night, 10:30 in the evening, right before John died, I get a phone call from his pastor and says, Doug, John wants to talk to you. He's dying. I get through the phone to the hospital in Springfield, Illinois. The nurses put me on the line, and John says, Doug, you're my best friend. Now we're best friends in the military. We're best friends in civilian life. And John says, I want to take my children on a fishing expedition on Lake Michigan to go out salmon fishing. Can you set it up? He's dying of cancer. We mobilized the team, kind of like our own make-a-wish. We got an ambulance. They took him in a gurney. They took him to Chicago, put him on a salmon fishing boat, on a hospital bed in the back of the boat, and he went fishing with his sons and his family. He got back on Monday, and he died on Tuesday. denied medical care by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and the Department of Defense for one of America's true heroes. Man after man after man. No matter what we did, no matter who we talked to, the medical care was refused. Kathleen Sullivan, one of your foremost journalists in California at the San Francisco Examiner and Chronicle, in 1998 sent a set of questions up to the Pentagon regarding DU. And in there, she knew the answers, and she said, what about all these regulations requiring medical care and treatment for everybody? And the answer came back, and I got it up here saying, we don't have to give medical care to them. And she asked about overexposure to radiation and medical care for that according to that Army regulation. Now, she's already got the Army regulations. She's already had a legal analysis, knows that they're required. And the Pentagon, Colonel Bob Cherry, sends the thing back and says, overexposure is not applicable to the deployed Army. Jesus Christ. You want your sons and daughters exposed to radiation with no limits because the Pentagon chief in the Pentagon says it's okay? 1998, the Office of Deputy Secretary of Defense, Office of Special Assistance to Gulf War Illnesses, gave a briefing to the President of the United States, Billy Boy Clinton. And in this briefing, they said point blank, that they knew there were 424 individuals that had high levels of uranium exposure. This is just our team. Friendly fire, the maintenance, 144th, the battle damage assessment, my team, the EOD experts, 424 people. But in 1998, they hadn't even notified half of the friendly fire casualties that they needed medical care. In fact, they'd only notified 120 individuals in 1998. Now, if you've heard the briefings recently, they're giving medical care to 90 people. Well, I'm one of the 90. I ain't been up there since March of 99. You ever call your doctor when you're sick and you need medical care and they don't return your phone call for 4 years? Ain't it grand? Well, despite all of the directives, time after time, we kept getting it going. We couldn't get it done. Finally, John Hamry, in January of 1999, sent a directive requiring training and education for all soldiers in the military. And he sent this directive to Warren Rudman. Hey, guys, ladies and gentlemen, you've got to understand Warren Rudman is the hitman for the administration to cover up everything. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the Undersecretary of Defense, the Chief of Staff of the Army, that's Eric Shinseki. So now he sent an order to Eric Shinseki saying, Eric, you got to comply with your own order. Wait a minute. Eric issued it in August of 1993, and the Secretary of Defense is telling him to comply with his order in 1999. What happened to 6 years? Chief of Naval Operations, Commandant of the Marine Corps, ma'am, you tell your son to stay home. Tell him to go to hell. Chief of Staff of the Air Force. Well, it keep going on. They never did it. They haven't done it yet. Well, I'm trying to get this together. In March of 1999, I get a letter from the Secretary of Defense. Yeah, Doug's out there pestering us again, man. We told him to clean this mess up and do medical care, and he's still doing his job. Now the Secretary of Defense, Bernie Rotzker, sends me a letter in March of 1999 and says, the law prohibits us from giving medical care to the people that are being exposed. I'm going, what? It's astonishing. The guy's denying medical care in violation of law. But he's immune to prosecution. He then goes on and says point blank, direct quote, quote, in fact, during and after the Gulf War, physicians and health physicists and the Office of the Army Surgeon General made a professional assessment of the exposures and determined that bioassays were not required. Now, he sends me this letter in March of 1999, and he tells me and my staff and my bosses that we, who wrote the directives for medical care, never wrote them. Who's a criminal here? And it goes on and on and on. Well, the problem you have with uranium munitions is it contaminates air, water, and soil. It causes immediate health effects within 72 hours. And there's no question about it because it happened to me and my staff and my team and the friendly fire casualties, and they refused to provide medical care for the U.S. casualties. And they're not doing it now. On April 14th, last week, Dr. Michael Kilpatrick, Deputy Secretary of Defense in charge of deployment medicine for the United States Department of Defense, deliberately and willfully stated to the world that they will not clean up uranium contamination in the Gulf caused by Gulf War II, and they will not provide medical care. And he cited as the reasons for this Dr. Pekka Vistö from the United Nations, who's in charge of the United Nations Environmental Program, and also Dr. Brian Spratt, who's the head of the British Royal Society. Now, you know, this is really neat, because the Deputy Secretary of Defense is saying we're citing these guys for not cleaning it up. Well, back on March 30th, a couple weeks before, Pekka Vistö, who I work with at the United Nations, and Karen Parker, who you've also heard about, sent me an email, said, "Hey, Doug, we did what you told. We told the United States to clean up the uranium contamination in the Balkans because it's trashed." Now, wait a minute. On April 14th, the Deputy Secretary of Defense is saying we don't have to clean it up. He's citing the United Nations. But 2 weeks before, the United Nations had told him to clean it up. It doesn't add up. Well, Brian Spratt jumped right into this, too, the other day, and he point blank told the United States to clean it up. They don't care. The problem you run into is cleaning the mess up. In order to clean up uranium contamination, and you have to understand, I've been in every U.S. vehicle that's been hit. I had the responsibility to clean it up. I had the responsibility to develop all of the procedures. I didn't ask for this job. I was ordered to do this job. A direct order, and it's up here if you want to read it. Multiple direct orders to do it. The Army made me their expert. I didn't ask for it. But what I learned from direct field research, not sitting behind a desk as a friggin' lab rat, but as an on-to-God site engineer and scientist who's in the nitty-gritty blowing things up. You got to remember, I'm just a science teacher, ladies and gentlemen. I teach high school biology and environmental science today, because I became persona non grata. I was director, after I did the DU project, I was offered an accepted position as director of the Edwin R. Bradley Radiological Laboratories. As a scientist, as a physicist, as an educator, as a military officer, that was the pinnacle of my profession, the top job in my field in the United States. And when I told they had to clean up the chemical, biological, and radiological contamination and provide medical care and kept up with that because that was my tasking, I became persona non grata. And when the United States continued under Project Shad to deliberately release chemical and biological warfare materials on U.S. citizens, as they did with Bacillus globigi in 1996 on the residents of Calhoun County in Anniston, Alabama, I went to the Army and said, "You got to clean up, provide medical care." Well, I did that before the weekend, and when I came back Monday morning, I was persona non grata. They had my office packed. They took my keys. They put me under house arrest for a month. That's what happens when you tell the U.S. they can't release chemical and biological materials on American citizens. And I tell you how much they did out here in California. Read Project Shad directives. Go look it up. You won't believe it. And it continues to this day. In 1993, a directive was sent to the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and the Department of Defense that makes Joseph Mengele look like Captain Kangaroo. Now, for those of you who don't know, in world history, Joseph Mengele is the Nazi death camp doctor. In this written directive in March of 1993, the United States Department of Defense told the doctors of the VA and the Department of Defense to leave uranium shrapnel and contamination within the soldiers that received it during Gulf War I. The purpose was, direct quote, ladies and gentlemen, quantification and documentation of radiological heavy metal toxicity and radiological cancer and tissue necrosis risks of embedded uranium fragments by A. Measuring and documenting uranium levels in each soldier using in vivo and in vitro measurement techniques. Determining the parameters and models needed to translate uranium levels into the body into estimates of increased cancer risk from exposure. 3. Comparing the clinical course of the body's response to uranium fragments with that of other non-uranium fragments to determine whether clinically significant differences exist due to either chemical or radiological properties of depleted uranium, and 4. Determine the risk of chronic kidney toxicity due to the long-term chronic exposure to elevated levels of uranium. In the history of mankind, the deliberate order to leave radiological and toxic materials in American soldiers for testing will go down in history beyond comprehension as a crime against God and humanity. It's right here. In the same directive, they were point blank stated that anybody that is excreting less than 14 micrograms per day of total uranium in their urine. Now remember, we excrete about 3 liters of urine per day. That's about how much urine you pass. So 14 micrograms per day, you require annual testing for urine and uranium, urine chemistry, uranium in the feces, tissue analysis, whole body counting, regional counting, uranium in the skeleton, uranium in the blood, blood chemistry, clinical evaluation, and diagnostic imaging. This is if anybody's excreting less than 14 micrograms a day. If you're excreting greater than 14 micrograms a day, and you're between 14 and 50 micrograms a day of solid uranium, your testing must be quarterly. If you excrete between 50 and 250 micrograms per day, your testing is monthly. You're going to have kidney toxicity. If you're excreting at 250, then your testing must be weekly in kidney toxicity. In 1995, the U.S. Department of Energy verified that I was excreting uranium in my urine at over 1,400 micrograms per day, and they didn't tell me for 2.5 years. That's what they did to the project director. I hate to tell you what they did to Dennis and the kids that he treated and the kids you saw in the video. And they haven't given it to the Iraqis or the coalition warriors or the citizens in Okinawa, in Vieques, Puerto Rico, in Hunter's Point, off the coast of Seattle, in Maryland, in Nevada, in New Mexico, in Florida, in Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Scotland, Germany. Beyond comprehension. The use of uranium munitions in war leaves a toxic waste and residue that cannot be physically removed. Because from my own research in the Nevada test site and during the Gulf War, you have to physically remove the destroyed structure or building entirely. You have to then completely package that up. If you watch the videotapes that I developed for the U.S. Army firsthand research, you will see that we packaged them up completely like a Hershey's Kiss. Then we took and transported those to some facility that could process them. Well, in the case of the United States, we sent 24 vehicles back to Barnwell, South Carolina, Savannah River, U.S. Department of Energy Research Site, called the Defense Consolidation Facility, in a multi-million dollar facility. It took 3 years to clean up and dispose of 24 U.S. vehicles. The highway of death is thousands of vehicles alone. All over Iraq now, we have thousands of vehicles. And if you haven't watched it, the Palestinian hotel they shot up last week, that was DU munitions. How about that? Let's see, how big is that hotel? Cruise missiles, bunker busters, all over the place. You have to physically remove the entire destroyed piece of whatever it is. Then you have to pick up every penetrator. Because these penetrators are solid rods of uranium. that are radiated for 4.5 billion years at 300 millirems per hour if you pick them up. Now, what Pekka Visto found and what Brian Spratt found and everybody found out is all over where they've been shot up. These things are really neat looking. The kids pick them up and play with them. The U.S. soldiers were picking them up and carrying them all over their place. They tie them on a chain and put them in their back pocket or tie them around their neck. Didn't they, Dennis? They're really neat looking things. Yeah, all over the place. Then you have to get a bulldozer and you have to scrape down to 6 inches out to about 100 meters and physically remove all that contaminated dirt. Now, I'm saying 100 meters, even though I confirmed and measured it out to 400 meters. We'll be conservative and save 100 meters. This is for each and every vehicle. Now, we ain't done it in Okinawa. We ain't done it anyplace else. They haven't done it up here at Hunter's Point. They sure as heck haven't done it in Iraq, and they sure as heck ain't going to do it now. And that's what Dr. Michael Kilpatrick point blank stated on April 14th. So as soon as he stated that, I called the Secretary of Defense, because you got to remember, I still got the 800 number. Bowers Raiders is so damn good that they still call us when they have problems. Got to understand, we were just all university scientists that got called to active duty. Because the U.S. Army ain't got the medical or scientific capability to do it without, you know, the civilians. They don't have it. They don't have it. What we have found out, and what disturbs me the most, is that after they made that directive, I called up the 800 number and I talked to them. I said, hey, have Barb or Austin or Mikey call me. And I said, Dr. Michael Kilpatrick is a friend. We just disagree, okay? He's the chief doctor in charge of the Department of Defense. Now, it doesn't matter. The congressional hearings held by Christopher Shades and Bernie Sanders about 3 weeks ago verified that the Department of Defense, with the acknowledgement and approval of Dr. Kilpatrick, refused to provide the pre-deployment physicals mandated by Congress and Department of Defense regulations for all the soldiers who got deployed to Gulf War II. It's in the records. Call the congressional up. Call up the congressman. They'll verify they refuse to do it. Direct violation. They don't care. So I called up there, and Austin Camacho called me back up on tax day, about 9:30 in the morning, and says, hi, Doug. Hey, by the way, you're right. We aren't going to provide medical care, and we're not going to clean up the environment. And I go, Austin, are you crazy? And he says, no, that's the policy decision. We don't have to, because there's no health and environmental effects. And I go, then why are my guys sick and dead? They don't care. They don't care. I'm going all over the place talking to anybody I can to finish my job. Today, ladies and gentlemen, the United States Department of Veteran Affairs has formally acknowledged that over 250,000 Gulf War I veterans are now permanently disabled due to Gulf War illness. A quarter of a million, over one-third of the force of our nation's finest sons and daughters are sick, with that whole host of things that Dennis went over and Loren went over. But it's far worse than that. The coalition soldiers are seeing it the same proportions. But the citizens of Iraq, whether they be the enemy soldiers or the women and the children, are devastating health effects. Reported ad nauseum by the World Health Organization and every other group. Kathy Kelly, the Pope's emissary. And the medical care and treatment it was required was prevented from taking off. A couple of years ago, I was called to Rome to meet with the NATO and Department of Defense and British Ministry of Defense people, Pope's representative on the Human Rights and Justice Commission, and everybody, as a consequence of the contamination in the Kosovo and the Balkans. The reason I was called over with Dr. Asa Durakovic and Carol Pico is because on April 16th of 1999, Denise Nichols, Rosalie Bertel, and myself and another individual were called to the White House to discuss uranium contamination with the Presidential Oversight Board by directive of the President of the United States. And we told them, don't use uranium munitions in Kosovo. We're going to see all the health and environmental effects. It happened, and they don't care. And they don't care. and they don't care. It continues to this day. The reason that medical care was never provided to the U.S. Friendly Fire casualties and the radio bioassay was never done is because if it was done, you would find the high levels of uranium exposure. And when the people got sick, you would have a direct correlation between exposures and adverse health effects. As predicted in October 30th of 1943 to General Leslie Groves. Not a question. Not a question. I wish it wasn't happening. In war, the job is to kill and destroy. When we destroy the entire infrastructure of a nation, release all the hazardous materials on that nation. When we shoot the place up with uranium munitions, we leave a toxic wasteland that you can't clean up and that you can't provide medical care for. I wish the hell that you could. You can't. And so what we see today, ladies and gentlemen, is that war has left a toxic wasteland wherever it's been done because of the technological devices that make war so simple. But also we destroyed our infrastructure, where the infrastructure today has gone into chemistry, better living through chemistry, the old thing, you know, ACS many years ago. But we can't clean up the contamination. Ladies and gentlemen, as an Army officer whose obligation is not only to the generals and the president, but to God, I'm here to tell you, war is obsolete. When you speak up, you become persona non grata. When the Army's experts spoke up on the health and environmental effects of uranium munitions and the environmental effects of war and combat, they all became persona non grata. They lost their careers. They lost their jobs. They had their houses ransacked. They had attempts to run them off the road. They have IRS audits all the time. It's sort of late. We did, back in December 26th of 1999, I did a 60-minute story, okay, on DU. We burned the Secretary of Defense on that story. Within 24 hours, every member of that whole story got IRS audits. Jeez, it was pretty neat. Now, they finally awarded me my disability, 40% disability for combat injuries from Gulf War I for uranium exposures. Medical records are up here cut and dried. And when they issued that to me, they said, well, Doug, we'll give you your medical care, we'll give you your disability, but we want you to stop speaking. Kind of neat, huh? You wouldn't believe the number of jobs I've been offered if I stopped talking. I could boost my salary up from $500 a month back up to $100,000 a year. But I ain't going to sell out. Now, what I didn't stop talking, you know, and trying to get medical care and environmental cleanup, they came up with a new trick. The United States Department of Veteran Affairs is garnishing my disability paycheck to pay for my medical care at the VA. It never quits. It never quits. I need your help. What I need you to do is to let everybody know that today supporting the troops means that you ensure that they have, number one, equipment that is not defective, which means that they're issued gas masks and chemical protective clothing that is not defective. The troops were sent to Gulf War II with defective equipment, totally confirmed by the United States General Accounting Office report, totally confirmed by the U.S. Army research on the functioning capability and wear of the gas mask. Guess who did that for the Army? I got another medal for that one, too. But I shouldn't have told them what I found. So they did that. The soldiers must have all the military education and training they need. Now, Dennis is an old frontline infantry combat type over there. probably one of the more foremost military units in the army. Now, those who've been in the military know when you're using small arms tactics and you're going into small areas where you're going into a house, that you spread out, okay? You know, you spread out, you know, got 5, 10, 15 meters between each other, right, when you're going in. Well, when you watch all these soldiers doing this stuff in Iraq, they run in with their head up the other guy's ass. Literally. You know, one grenade or one burst of machine gun fire is going to kill them all. Well, Colonel Dave Hackworth and I and a whole bunch, we've written more and more and talked to the military trying to get proper education and training because they don't know what they're doing. Last Friday, ROTC, University of Illinois, the Illini, Daily Illini, newspaper for the University of Illinois, took a picture of ROTC troops training for war with M16 laying outside the campus building in the middle of the U of I campus with the picture taken in front of the guy aiming the M16. That's what they're teaching our kids today. I sent a letter up to the ROTC commander. I sent a letter to the deputy chief of police for the University of Illinois, who happens to be a good friend because I'm on their advisory board. We got an email back today. And Dennis, the guy, the police chief, said he'd all jumped all over the colonel already about this, right? Big time. This is, they're teaching our kids. Weapons training? There's something wrong here. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, supporting the troops means that when they come back from war, they have the full medical, that means physiological and psychological care that they earn defending our nation. No matter who they are, no matter what war they served in, whether they're World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Panama, Grenada, Gulf War I, and now Gulf War II. The United States Department of Veteran Affairs has stated explicitly that they are unable to accept any more individuals for medical care and treatment in their system. They can't provide medical care for two of us in this room that are already disabled due to previous combat injuries from service to our nation, because we got a 200-day waiting period to get in for medical care if we can get it. And now we just took the bravest of our sons and daughters to war again to bring them back and dump them in our streets without any medical care. And Dr. Michael Kilpatrick has stated he's not going to give it. What's wrong with this picture? Today, I don't even know what town we went in. They took me to see the beach. I hardly ever see the ocean. I live in the middle of cornfields. Okay, I live in a farm in the middle of cornfields in Illinois. And they took me, where'd we go to?
We went to the boardwalk.
To the boardwalk, okay. It was really neat. You know, Clint Eastwood movie was made there. I'm walking to, hey, this is where Clint Eastwood was at when they did the movie. We came back. We stopped in this community. What was the name of that town?
Los Gatos.
I understand that is the richest community in this area. Well, there's some guys out there support the troops with the flags and the signs, right? So we went around, went back, and I was going to invite them to come to the talk tonight. Support the troops, you know? This is my job. So we stopped, rolled our windows down, introduced ourselves. So I'm Major Rocky, Army Medical Officer. This is Drill Sergeant Dennis Kine, a drill sergeant, the guy that trains the troops, is still training the troops, okay? And we invited him, and we said, by the way, we needed medical care for these guys. And they go, what? You know, medical care? What do you want us to do? And so we kept talking to these guys, saying, well, we got a 250,000 sick. I can't get medical care. The VA just slashed the budget by $25 million while we go to war, so they don't have the medical care abilities. And these guys got mad at us. Now, you know, I'm sitting there. He's in the back seat. I'm in the front seat in the passenger's car. And all of a sudden, I look up. This guy's getting madder and madder. He takes the American flag, and he's coming at me like I'm Mount Sebastian, Iwo Jima, trying to plant the American flag in my ear. This morning. And all I asked them to do was help me get medical care for American warriors. I've been called a communist. I've been called a traitor. But I'm still serving our nation. Ladies and gentlemen, help me. Help our veterans. Help our nation. And help the citizens of the world. If we continue to go to war, and we continue to contaminate God's environment, We will continue to make the citizens of the world sick. But more important, we're going to continue to kill the children of the world. And I don't know if you've ever been to war, but I can guarantee you there ain't no atheists in a foxhole. And no matter what religion you are, no what culture you come from, there is a prophecy. And a child shall lead them to peace. But if you kill the children of the world, where's that child going to come from that leads us to peace? Thank you.